Welcome, everybody. You are listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I am your host, Tom Hush, and joining me, as always, is my beautiful co-host, Connor Cornelius. Connor, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Tom. Especially, I could have used that compliment a little bit earlier, but, you know, now that you're doing it now.
I mean, now or never.
Yeah.
Now or never.
Yeah.
I would have preferred never, but you looked a little sad. I thought that, you know, his eyes are so dark, and his complexion is just...
It's the mascara's running.
Running. Like, you have a dry spot on your right ear.
Do I?
It's crackly. Do you have eczema?
It's inconsistent.
Okay.
So I'll give an inconsistent answer.
Yeah, if it were consistent, I would suggest a dermatologist. But, I mean, if it's inconsistent, just Lubriderm or something. You know, just get a little...
Something over the counter.
Yeah, you're listening to Ear Health with Connor and Tom. Taking care of your dry ears since 2017. But, anyway, back to...
You know what goes well with ear cream?
Yeah, what?
Box office.
Box office, naturally. We're going to be talking a little bit later about some comments made by two large figures in the film industry, Joss Whedon and James Cameron, who, if you're keeping up with film news, have said some pretty dumb things, wouldn't you say, Connor?
Yeah. James Cameron has been pretty ridiculous in all of his public appearances ever since he said he's going to just do Avatar movies for the next 5-10 years or whatever it is.
It's just been on a sliding scale of absurdity.
Yeah.
He made some comments about the fantastically successful Wonder Woman movie that the director, Patty Jenkins, definitely took umbrage with, and I think you and I, Connor, we really thought that it was a poor move on behalf of Mr. Cameron.
Yeah, it's like a what is he doing kind of moment. So we're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Absolutely. And we'll also take a look at a recent letter that was written about Joss Whedon, a man who is considered an icon in film geekdom for his work on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Firefly, The Avengers. He was a big figure for people. And his ex-wife recently wrote an open letter for everybody to read that talked a little bit about Joss outside of his public space and you know, some things that he has been doing and ways that he has been approaching his work that don't really add up to the way that we, I guess, previously thought of Joss. So like I said, we'll get to that, but for right now,
The summer's winding down.
Yes.
It's late August.
And
so it's time to take a look back at the summer movie season.
Fantastic. And that's what we're going to do right now here in our news segment.
News. News. Yeah, 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 yeah.
It's the news. The news. News. The news. News coming soon. Coming soon to a theater near you.
Oh, yeah.
Come on now. Gonna talk about what's going on. What's going on. What's going on.
Yeah!
All right. So right now, winding down summer, all the big movies really for the summer season have come out. We've seen Wonder Woman. We've seen Dunkirk, Spider-Man Homecoming. Lots of big movies that came out this summer. And we're getting into the fall. Really, I think, starting with the release of It coming on September 8th. But we want to take a look back here at the summer box office, which has been interesting, wouldn't you say, Connor?
Interesting and almost entirely unsurprising, maybe.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, save for a few nice surprises.
Yeah.
But
it was a great summer for original filmmaking, I think. Mm-hmm. Baby Driver from Edgar Wright was great. Obviously, Christopher Nolan continuing his spree of not making a bad movie with Dunkirk.
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
There were some problems with it, obviously, but...
No, but you're absolutely right. There were some highlights, definitely, but I don't know. It was kind of a middling summer. So we wanted to talk a little bit about what were those highlights and what were the lowlights of the summer. And we're going to be following a great article written by Scott Mendelson over at Forbes, and he kind of highlights himself the winners and losers of the summer movie season. First, he brings up for the big winner, comic book superhero movies, which seems for the last few years, I'd say almost the last 10 years, have pretty much consistently been winners of the summer box office. Wouldn't you say?
Wouldn't I say? Yes, I would. And it's also interesting because you'd think that after so many consecutive years of these things dominating the box office, audiences might be coming a little fatigued by it. Not the case at all.
Not at all. We have some serious records being broken here. We're looking at Wonder Woman with $404 million at the box office, Guardians 2 with $389, Spider-Man Homecoming $315 million. I mean, they're juggernauts. Say what you will about the quality of them. And to be fair, all three of those movies were really well reviewed,
yeah.
Especially Wonder Woman. People were really turned on to Wonder Woman. Guardians 2, in my personal opinion, was even – I liked it better than the first one. And
really?
Yeah, I feel like it advanced the story a lot, and it was what I hoped from it. As a comic book movie, as a fan of that particular property, and Spider-Man Homecoming, bringing back Spider-Man and incorporating it into the MCU, not bad at all.
Yeah,
not
very bad fresh, I thought.
Exactly. And, you know, it seems like it's really only going to continue with these big franchises. We've got more and more and more Marvel movies to look forward to coming down the line, especially with in the next couple of years, we'll have the new Avengers movies that will kind of cap off this 10-year juggernaut, you know, this 10-year run on the MCU and kind of open things up for the future, which is just going to keep going. Luckily for DC, they had Wonder Woman, which was finally the hit that they had hoped for critically.
Yep.
Because Batman vs. Superman did not do poorly financially. It made a lot of money. But Wonder Woman was both financially successful and a good movie to boot.
Yeah, it was the most successful film directed by a woman of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was $800 million grossed internationally.
Yeah, something ridiculous. Something ridiculous. And congratulations to Patty Jenkins for coming out and just swinging for the fences. I mean, she made Monster in 2003 and then didn't really do features for a long time. She made, you know, went came in, made an incredible film with Charlize Theron, like an Oscar-winning film, and then was just kind of like, all right, I'm going to not do a feature for a long time. And then she comes back and does another great feature. So shout out to Patty Jenkins for doing a great job. The only thing I'm worried about with this, and we might see this in summers to come, is a serious fatigue with superhero movies. I know I'm really feeling it. I've really only attached myself to a few movies that are of the superhero genre that I really want to see. Like, I'll always watch a Guardians of the Galaxy because I love James Gunn as a director and a writer. I really like those characters. I'm down to see it regardless of how big and bloated it might be.
Yeah, exactly. And also with the DC properties, I've got to say I have never felt such fatigue with a franchise before. It's like I really want them to do something good, but now that I've seen Wonder Woman, I'm still just like, okay, now what are they doing? You look up what their next plans are. They're doing a couple Joker movies with Jared Leto, like the antithesis of the feminist superhero. So it's like, is DC learning from their mistakes at all, or are they just Yeah, are they just powering through because of the box office results?
Well, and later this year, they're going to hopefully, what they're guessing is going to be their Avengers moment, which is the release of Justice League, bringing together all the characters that they've set up so clumsily in previous films, because they're just like, well, you know, we got to play catch up with Marvel, and we'll see how it goes. I know Zack Snyder has been the creative czar behind all of these movies so far, even the ones that he hasn't directed, he's had a hand in, and you know, it didn't necessarily work. And he had done Justice League, but then unfortunately he had a very terrible tragedy strike his family, and he stepped away. And Joss Whedon actually came to finish it up, and from what has been said, there have been a lot of expensive reshoots, a lot of retooling of the story late in the game, which does not bode well for a film. Like, yeah. That much retooling usually does not help a film.
We saw that with Suicide Squad, another DC property.
Exactly, and we saw it even in Rogue One. They did extensive reshoots because of scheduling conflicts. And that's not to say that reshoots are inherently a bad thing.
No.
Reshoots happen.
But there seems to be a pattern, right? And it's not encouraging necessarily.
Yeah. Constant reshoots, constant expensive reshoots that largely shape out the story in a way that it was not originally shot. So I think we'll cap off the winner for those, but I will say, losers on the flip side, non-superhero live-action franchises. Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. It did $787 million worldwide, but it was really underwhelming. King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, The Mummy, Transformers, even War for the Planet of the Apes.
Which was a great movie.
I really enjoyed it. But I just don't think people were really that into it, which is sad. I liked it a lot. I thought they did a good job, and I'm coming from a biased perspective. I really love the Planet of the Apes movies, so it's unfortunate to hear that. But The Dark Tower also totally just straight down.
And I think an interesting thing that has emerged from this summer is that the expectation when you hear that a team like Matthew McConaughey and Idris Elba are going to be in a movie together, or Tom Cruise is going to be helming a reboot of a Universal monster, or Johnny Depp is reprising one of his most famous roles. You would think that these movies are going to be pulling in huge audiences. Obviously, Pirates of the Caribbean did, but for the most part, it does seem like the star power, which a lot of major studios rely upon, is not performing as well as they imagined that it would.
Yeah, it's starting to fade. And it also goes to show that word of mouth and critical consensus has kind of returned as a very important factor in whether or not people are seeing these movies, which brings us to the next point in this article, is the one winner, movie critics. Yeah. There's been a lot of think pieces written about Rotten Tomatoes and review aggregators and things of that nature, and what they're calling the Rotten Tomatoes effect. People go and look at those aggregators. Now, I do have some problems with Rotten Tomatoes because it takes away the nuance of a review. I really like scoreless reviews.
Mm-hmm.
I really like reviews that focus on not like just taking the movie at face value, like just watching the movie and writing about the movie, what they liked, what they didn't like. And you have to read it to understand the opinion, instead of you can go to Rotten Tomatoes and it's like, oh well, it's only a 65, you know.
Yeah, forming an opinion should not be a regurgitation.
Exactly.
It should be a thoughtful process.
Yeah, and I think less and less people necessarily have reviewers that they really like. I've gotten to the point where I was totally into Rotten Tomatoes. I thought, oh wow, this is great, this is really going to help me choose a movie. But then I realized the problems with it, and that sometimes, you know, I don't necessarily agree with that Rotten Tomatoes score. So what I've gone to is really looking at specific critics that I enjoy the writing of, or at least generally agree with. Amy Nicholson, formerly of LA Weekly and MTVnews.com. I really like to watch her, listen to her reviews or read her reviews. I really like Richard Brody from The New Yorker. Even though I disagree with him a lot, I like to know his thoughts, and I think it really rounds things out. So maybe moving to reading specific critics and knowing which ones that you agree with and get your taste in movies might help you get a better movie experience.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, but it seems like Rotten Tomatoes, the effect on the summer box office was mostly negative.
Yeah.
In the sense that it got people, it helped people avoid bad movies like Baywatch, The Mummy, Transformers 5. You know, it really helped them do that.
Yeah, which is good, because if we want studios to change the way that they're releasing films and the things that they're pumping their budgets into, then that's important, right?
Yeah, speak with your wallet.
Away. Exactly.
Yeah.
But also things like where otherwise good movies like War for the Planet of the Apes was totally pigeonholed because all of the critics said it's got a very bleak ending, mm-hmm. which you could guess going into it if you knew anything about it.
But if you know anything about the Planet of the Apes franchise,
yeah.
What's bleaker than like, damn you, damn you all to hell? They fucking blew up the planet.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what you were expecting.
Yeah, like, did you not know that who won the war for the Planet of the Apes?
Yeah, it's not humanity, I tell you that much.
But yeah, it kind of scared people away from it. And obviously, there are a lot of bleak things happening very publicly in the world right now.
Yeah.
And maybe people in the summer are not looking for a movie that makes them contemplate the folly of man.
The end of all time. The end of all time.
Yeah.
So... another point is that the good reviews couldn't really save everything. It definitely didn't save Logan Lucky, which is too bad because, I mean, that was kind of that. I'll be seeing it soon. It's going to be coming to the theater that I work at in the next week, but I'll definitely be seeing it. It looks great. I love Steven Soderbergh. I'm really excited. And it stinks that that one didn't do better. It didn't really help Detroit all that much. You know, it didn't do it. You know, critics can't save everything, but I think it might at least give some of these things a life later on in home release. People who skipped it in the theaters will be like, well, you know what? This got really good reviews and now I can watch it for like, I don't know, $5 on iTunes, you know. So hopefully that'll help on the back end. As we kind of said earlier, one loser is movie stars.
Losers.
They lost. Scarlett Johansson and Amy Schumer couldn't help Rough Night or Snatched. Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, couldn't help Baywatch. Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey couldn't change The Dark Tower. Johnny Depp didn't help Pirates. I think that's because people are turning against Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
And rightfully so. He's
literally phoning it in nowadays.
Yeah.
He has an assistant on stage. He wears an earpiece. And the guy just feeds him his lines so that Johnny Depp doesn't have to read scripts before he goes on.
Good God. Hitman's Bodyguard also didn't really get helped with
Ryan Reynolds. Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, nothing really there. I want to get to this one. This is a really important one. One of the winners, according to the article, and shout out to Scott Mendelson for making this a point, is that one of the winners was women. And I think that's absolutely true. Not just with Wonder Woman, but you had Girls Trip, which was a really big success. That's been playing in theaters for a long time now.
The director of that movie just got a first look deal with Universal. Is
exactly.
that right?
Exactly. He got his first look deal, which is great because he's been making a lot of great films already. I know he did the Best Man Holiday franchise, the two movies that are part of that. I think this was a good year for women.
And Charlize Theron and Atomic Blonde.
Again, they didn't do great in the box office, but I think the fact of existence is really important. The fact that we have a female-led action film that's leading to more. You know, I want to see more female-led action. I just want to see more female-led films. I don't think that's too much to ask. I think this summer has proved that female-led films have an audience, clearly, despite the fact that it's been denied for so long. So I'm glad that they're one of the winners. If you guys have any specific thoughts, who are your winners and losers of the summer box office? Who do you think the winners and losers of the coming fall and winter seasons of films? I mean, this is when we're expecting a lot of prestige films, you know, Oscar contenders. What are we going to see? What are you excited about? Please let us know. Head on over to facebook.com/NoCoCinemaPodcast and throw it up on the page. I want to see what you think. I'm excited.
Yeah.
I like to hear your thoughts. Speaking of box office, it looks like this weekend the box office is going to be
steamrolled.
Yeah. To put it in a word, I suppose, steamrolled by the Mayweather-McGregor pay-per-view fight on Showtime. We're looking at projections of $700 million worldwide, $500 million plus in the U.S. alone. And according to Deadline.com, if that were a movie, the figure would easily land it in the top 10 list of highest grossing films of all time.
And what does that mean for movies that are coming out this weekend, Tom?
It means they're pretty much screwed.
Yeah.
There's really not a whole lot to help the box office this weekend. I mean, this is an extremely well-anticipated fight. I know you in fact are going to be watching it.
Mm-hmm.
They're having massive parties.
Everywhere.
You're going to a party.
Yeah.
You're going to be sipping on a brewski.
I get to go to a party
to watch this fight. It's going to be big. You know, this is huge. $700 million for a fight that could potentially last less than like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Who knows? Floyd Mayweather could just... knockout, just immediate knockout, or McGregor gets disqualified by kicking him in the head or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or it drags on for like 2 hours and it's the most boring thing that anyone's ever seen because Mayweather's motto seems to be float like a butterfly. And that's it. There is no end. That's the end.
He just waits him out.
Yeah.
And now I don't know shit about boxing.
Me either.
But... I watched the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, and I was really pissed. I wish I had been watching a movie.
Yeah.
That was really not very good. I wasn't really that invested in it. And let's just look at the movies that are coming out. We've got Leap, which is a sweet animated movie about a ballerina.
Mm.
Probably not going to do gangbusters. The Sony faith-based film All Saints...
I'm sure that'll do well, actually.
Yeah, that's doing all right. I mean, the biggest thing, really, the one that I would see is Birth of the Dragon, which is the new Bruce Lee biopic that's coming out, and it's a collaboration between Blumhouse. Their label called Tilt, Blumhouse Tilt, and WWE Studios.
Hey-o.
Hey. They've got this biopic, Birth of the Dragon, coming out. It's about Bruce Lee and his ascension after this big fight that he has. I don't really know much about it. I'm glad I don't know much about it because I'd rather watch it and learn all about it.
Yep.
But even that is really not going to make much, you know. And they really realistically, that would be trying to capture the audience that the fight is going to get.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fighting... Hopefully, it's going to wet the whistle of those ready for a fight. But the fight is tonight. I'm guessing no one's taking off, you know, to go run to the movies quickly before the fight starts. You're going to be sitting. You're going to be watching the pregame. You're going to be chugging Bud Light like there's no tomorrow, you know?
Going to be drowning in vodka. Drowning in vodka and fatty trans fats. Oh, Jesus.
The worst kind of trans fats.
Yeah,
the fatty
guys. Oh,
God. So, I mean, RIP box office for August 26th.
Better luck next weekend.
Yeah. I hope we do better next weekend. And at least we have It to look forward to. I think that could be... people seem excited about It from what I've seen. A lot of people have gone back and watched the original, and they're getting like hyped about it. They're like, oh, yeah, no, I remember this. This used to scare me as a kid. This so freaked me out. I hate clowns. You know, so I hope It does well, even though I'm not the biggest Stephen King fan. It's too bad that The Dark Tower was a total bust, but maybe this will do better because God knows... he needs the money.
Yeah, seriously.
He's so poor.
Yeah, Stephen King.
What can you do? Connor, let's get into something legal here. I loved talking last week about the legal battle between the producers of The Walking Dead and AMC. Let's get into more legal stuff. We've got some age censorship law that we're going to be talking about here. Connor, what's the skinny?
So IMDb has filed a lawsuit to get rid of something which is called the IMDb law, which essentially allows actors and actresses who put their information up on that website the right to basically remove their age information so that their potential employers cannot illegally age discriminate against them.
Mm-hmm.
And the joint union SAG-AFTRA has publicly denounced this lawsuit because they think that there is a problem of inclusivity in Hollywood already, and they don't want studios to be able to engage in this age discrimination practice, which they perceive as something which is a real problem with the industry.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. This is kind of a tough one. This is a super tough one because SAG-AFTRA absolutely has a point with ageism in Hollywood. There have been many serious discussions and even comedic discussions about how older actors, especially women, are aged out because they're not sexy anymore. You can't, you get to age 40 and all of a sudden you can only play mothers and, I feel like that's just it. Just like, well, we've got a role on an ABC sitcom that's going to fail in about 6 months, so you can play the mom, and that's pretty much it. That becomes your career, and older women are not seen as viable actors. However, I do think that IMDb, I mean, there's a point there. I think I should be able to know an actor's age. If I'm curious, I'm like, oh, how old is John Travolta?
Right. There's that problem, right? Because, for example, the SAG-AFTRA, the current president, Gabriel Carteris, was a star on Hollywood 90210, or Beverly Hills 90210. And she was 30 when she was auditioning for a role of a 19-year-old. And when they eventually chose her, a couple of seasons had gone by, the show had become successful, and then they eventually found out how old Gabrielle was, and some of the producers approached her and said, you're really lucky that we didn't know how old you were when we offered you this job. However, so that's one example of
And that's
them.
Some real Hollywood scummy stuff that is happening and is despicable. It is wrong.
But then again, you got stuff on the other side. Everybody's heard, the thing with Mila Kunis when she was 15 years old, and she was auditioning for a role of a 19-year-old. And she was going to be making out with people who were in their mid-20s or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like statutory rape. That's technically statutory.
Well, it's
sexual misconduct or something.
It's wrong, yeah. If you are over the age of, if she's 15 and she's making out with Ashton Kutcher, who's like in his 20s, there's, at the very least, there's something weird about that, if not legally legally wrong. And it's that's the difficult part. Yeah, yeah. Because even in one of the biggest movies of all time, Apocalypse Now, Lawrence Fishburne lied about his age so that he could be in Apocalypse Now. And it's a good thing because now we have a great performance from young Lawrence Fishburne, and that that probably helped launch his career. On the other hand, that could have been a huge liability. That could have been a massive liability because he's a minor. When someone's a minor, things have to, there are work laws for minors. They can't work more than so many hours in a day. They have to be going to school in certain cases, and they have to be doing this, that, and the next thing.
And the conditions of that, the creation of that film were hectic, to say the least.
Apocalypse Now is, famously hectic and dangerous shoot with all the things that were going on. So knowing an actor's age is important. I think it's really important. But I think the ageism is rampant. And what it comes down to is changing the culture where you need to know someone's age for legal reasons, mm-hmm. In terms of work and, things that come along with that, especially minors. I feel like with the age thing, we're a lot talking about minors in terms of safety. And then when it comes to people who are older, I guess, just stop discriminating based on age. Look, it's about how they look. No one can tell you how old they are just from looking at someone, not super accurately, not without like some level of guessing. So in the case of a movie like Superbad, Jonah Hill was like 30 years old playing a high schooler. Do you think anybody knew that?
I didn't.
I sure as didn't. Like, I
was
did not
convinced.
Want. I was convinced he was a high schooler. Even Michael Cera was older than high school age, but that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter if you just believe that they're the age that they're supposed to be playing. So, on one end, producers, stop being ageist. It's stupid. Let people act.
Just go with your gut.
Go with your gut.
On what you think is going to be a good performance.
Yeah, exactly. And on the other hand, it's important to know what an actor's age is outside of just movie trivia. You need to know because there could be some safety concerns. There could be some legal concerns. Just be honest about your age. And hopefully we can change the culture enough so that people in Hollywood can be honest about their age without being afraid of being discriminated against because of it. All right. Next up, we're going to be talking a little bit about Mr. Joss Whedon and Mr. James Cameron, about some recent things that have come out, some statements made, some letters written, and dig into that a little bit, and maybe peel back some of the layers of these two filmmakers. Won't you join us? I think it'll be a fantastic conversation. You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGM Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. Back in just a bit. Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGM Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I am your host, Tom Hush, joined again, as always, by my co-host, Connor. Connor, thanks for making it through the break. And I see your complexion is kind of, it's brightened up a little bit.
I'm brightening up. I'm blushing. I'm having a great time.
We might be able to finally do this on video.
Yeah.
If you could. Okay. You know, just.
All right, Tom, you know what? I was having a good day, and now all of a sudden you just got to go ahead and with a backhanded comment like that.
I'm sorry, Connor. Well, I mean, if we're going to keep playing up this dynamic for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, I'm honey, you're, or well, I'll be vinegar. You can be.
Salt?
Is that?
That's
is
it, that right?
The, it's. I think so. I think that's usually.
Let's not do this in front of our guests.
No, right? never. As we talked about in the previous segment, we want to get into some pretty lame comments that were made by two giant figures of the film industry, Joss Whedon and also James Cameron. With James Cameron, it's more of his comments regarding the film Wonder Woman, directed by Patty Jenkins. Recently broke the record for being the single most successful film ever made by a female filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And a letter that was written about Joss Whedon by his ex-wife, who revealed some things that Joss has since publicly said were not exactly as they happened, as someone accused of cheating might want to say to the world. But we'll discuss it anyway, because I think it's important to get that perspective. And helping us do that today is Amy Guth. She is the host of the Saturday Night Special. She also does the business lunch on Saturdays for WGN. And she also does so many other things. Are you the president of Strange Ways?
I'm the founder and executive director of Strange Ways, which is a multimedia film and other things production company.
Oh, excellent.
But shout out to Rex Hupke.
Yes.
I am also one half of Guth and Hupke on Politics, which is a very exhausting political talk show. But the weeks that we have skipped because he's been on vacation have been excruciating, because it never fails that very important political news happens that week, but also it sort of counts as weekly political therapy.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I can imagine the next one when he comes back will simply balloon and pop into a glorious explosion of political decompression. So if you I feel like many people already know Amy, and we're just excited to have her here. So thank you so much, Amy, for coming on to talk a little bit about this. I want to start with James Cameron, because he's considered one of the, not untouchables, but
one of the most successful of all time.
Yeah. I mean, he's made some of the largest film franchises. The Terminator franchise is kind of on his back. Aliens back in the day. And now with his Avatar series that he's going to do into perpetuity, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that seems to be his plan. He seems to take umbrage with Wonder Woman. And it's really kind of for the dumbest reason. He claims that Wonder Woman has been the subject of self-congratulatory backpatting on the part of Hollywood, which is, I think, incredibly offensive towards Patty Jenkins. I think incredibly offensive towards people who legitimately enjoyed the movie. And really just a crappy thing to say. He claims that Wonder Woman is male Hollywood doing the same old thing on account of the fact that he feels Wonder Woman as a character is an objectified icon.
And the reason that he's saying that is because Wonder Woman is beautiful, right?
Yeah, he takes issue with the fact that Gal Gadot, I believe is how you pronounce her last name, she is just a very pretty woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, everything's subjective. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but she is a very beautiful woman. She's physically fit. She's
wearing a form-fitting uniform.
Yeah. So, and he takes that to be, oh, this is some male gaze stuff. This is, I think he's trying to be progressive thinking, but ultimately comes off as a dick.
Right.
Because
he takes one toxic view of femininity in Hollywood and he just trades it in for his own, which is not any better than the one that the Michael Bays use, right?
True. Amy, can you help us work through this? Because we're just a couple of white guys.
Help.
We're lost.
Well, I mean, this, in my opinion, is very much about something that we see a lot politically. We see this in a lot of industries in which it is constantly it is very customary to attack, usually a woman, but not always, but attack when absolute male privilege is threatened. We saw this play out in the 2016 presidential election, right? Because the idea of Obama threatened a certain group, and then suddenly, whether or not you liked Hillary, suddenly, like, here was this one office that even subconsciously it was very easy to believe could only be held by a certain person, and that was an old white guy. Suddenly, that kind of foundation was a bit rocked, and I think that's really what we're seeing here, just in such an absurdly douchey way. it got him nothing to say what he said. It was totally needless. There was really no purpose for it because it did him no favors. People that are in the like Hollywood brosif seats of power are probably like, yeah, right on, brother. But mostly people are like, what an asshole, right? For the most part, that's what people are saying.
Absolutely.
So Patty Jenkins fired back with a really, I thought, lovely well-played comment that I think made some really good and important points, particularly where she's describing, you know, the way that women are denied being fully multidimensional beings on screen or in their professional lives. It's this idea that you have to be a certain kind of badass, but you better not be too good looking, or else somehow you're objectifying yourself or someone is objectifying you. You're allowing yourself to be objectified if you are too good looking in the eye of the beholder. So it's like, be a badass, but don't have feelings, because then you're some kind of hysterical woman. So be a badass, but don't have feelings, but don't be too good looking. And, you know, and if we have to be that, then we're not allowed to be the fully multidimensional beings that men are allowed to be on screen and that men are allowed to be in their film careers, which is very unfair. So he is, this feels like an insecure small person being very threatened and lashing out like a, you know, if you like push someone into a corner, they just start fighting back ferociously, and that's really what this feels like in his case, because it really got him nothing to say that. Nothing.
And I find it super ironic that he's coming from this perceived moral high ground of, oh, I'm the guy that created Sarah Connor. Sarah Connor, the absolute badass woman who fought, who was the, you know, the mother of humanity in the apocalyptic robot future. And I think it's not wrong to say that that role did break some ground in terms of women being action heroes, because Terminator 2, considered one of the best, you know, action films of all time, starring a woman in that role being really the central ass-kicking figure. Even in his turn in the Alien franchise with Aliens, he made Ripley a big action star for guys. And I think that's, and women as well. People really saw Sigourney Weaver and were like, wow, she's amazing. Like, this is so crazy. But perhaps he thinks that that's the only way it can be done.
Right.
And you were right with Ms. Jenkins' statements, where it's like, yes, strong women are, you know, are strong women. However, it's about being multidimensional. Why can't Wonder Woman be pretty, for lack of a better word.
Right.
Why can't women be emotional on screen and still be strong women?
And still be credible.
Exactly.
Right?
Credibility.
The minute you have any feelings, then suddenly it's, you know, you're being hysterical. I mean, we see this play out in our lives daily, where if you, say, stand up for something, or you see something, someone doing something inappropriate, and you say, hey, what are you doing? You know, don't speak that way to a woman on the street or whatever. Suddenly it's like, whoa, you crazy bitch. You know, it's like this unbelievable double standard. But what I think, you know, the idea that it's that he has some kind of credibility here because of Ripley and because of Sarah Connor, to me, lands like saying, I'm going to tell this super racist joke, but it's fine because I have a black friend.
Right.
I mean, it feels like that to me, which I just think is really flawed and really problematic, because, again, this just, it keeps making him look more and more insecure about this, of like, listen, damn it, I'm the king of this Hollywood thing, and I make the smart, tough women. Don't you dare come in here into my space and make this woman in the way that, like, don't do that. That's mine. I'm taking my toys and going home. That's really, it feels like a very childish move on his part, which I just find totally, wholly unprofessional.
And it also almost seems like he didn't, for one, maybe understand the role of the character in the movie, because she was beautiful, but that wasn't something that worked in her favor necessarily. She had to work through that so that she could maintain her credibility, you know? And it also seems sort of like James Cameron doesn't even understand the powerful woman roles that he has created in his career. He doesn't understand what makes a powerful woman powerful in the first place.
Yeah, looking at it is weird to see a lot of directors look back at James Cameron's work, especially when it comes to casting women in action roles. He fails to see what his roles have evolved into, and as time goes on, those roles are going to change. You know, they're not always going to be the same way. He might have made some headway with that with the help of his female producer, Gail Ann Hurd, who is a fantastic producer in her own right and helped create the Terminator franchise. So this isn't all just James Cameron. This is a collaboration. He doesn't like to see their own roles evolve, you know, which is sad. And if James Cameron fades into obscurity because he can't keep up with the way that women are evolving in cinema, then good riddance.
Yeah.
Tough.
I mean, to me, that's what he's done is the cinematic equivalent of Make America Great Again.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It's like, no, this one very narrow white male supremacy way is the way that America is. And if we don't turn around to that, we have a problem. I mean, that's really what he said. Like, no, this is very threatening to me to have this other dimension. You also have to look at the original creation of Wonder Woman as a character made by William Moulton Marston, who was a very unconventional person, right? He lived with his wife and his other female partner, and she was related to Margaret Sanger somehow, who, you know, founder of Planned Parenthood, and he really was very thoughtful about, like, the lasso of truth was important, and the outfit, like, he really was speaking against certain systemic issues of sexism at the time. It was very important to see her bust out of chains and have a lasso of truth telling. It was a response to a lot that was happening sociopolitically. And there was a documentary that I'm don't quote me on this, but I think it was partially funded by public television that was looking at people who subsequently drew Wonder Woman after he died, and his estate was kind of the position that he would have been horrified, because they responded, it was drawn from kind of the James Cameron space. It was sort of like, well, let's cover her a little so she doesn't exploit herself. That's the point, that her legs will kill you. She will choke you to death. It is a practical matter that she doesn't wear a long skirt. And also, don't tell me to cover myself. Right.
Exactly.
Like, so she was at one point, there's a one cell of the comic in which she has a much longer skirt and she's pushing like a baby carriage that is often pointed to as like a place where she got way off track because of who was drawing her. So I think we even have to look at the context of Wonder Woman. And to that end, I think it's kind of a perfect, you know, it's a perfect thing that this is the character that created this thing that's rattled all these, you know, very undisputably very successful, but nonetheless, like, who in Hollywood has a ton more privilege and power than James Cameron? He's got a shitload of it, right?
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
got a lot of... If he was like, woke up and said, you know, today I would like to make a film about a glass of orange juice, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, just because that's what...
$50 million budget.
And it's going to be a blockbuster
yeah.
like, glass of orange juice,
yeah.
You know, which I think is interesting. So you mentioned Gail Ann Hurd. I heard her speak at Blog Her in Chicago a few years ago. And there she gets some criticism from women of like, she's not all she's cracked up to be. And I've heard like wisps of that here and there. But nonetheless, this is what she was talking about. She was talking about early in her career when she was leaving UCLA, I think. Roger Corman had said, send me the brightest people from this graduating class and I'd like to employ them. And I'm going to groom into this super producer.
Mm-hmm.
And she arrived and she says this like with a degree of shame and as a cautionary tale, but she said, you know, it was the '70s, whatever. And I arrived thinking I was going to be his secretary. I did not realize I was stepping into like my fate was changing forever right there. And until he specifically said, no, dummy, I'm hiring you to,
yeah.
like, I'm grooming you for this. And she said it wasn't until she had started the process of Armageddon, because that was really her first kind of solo biggie, mm-hmm. in which she said, oh, wait, I do know what the hell I'm doing. Up until that, she had just kind of, she said, shame on me, but I had spent a lot of time deferring power to him, and he knew I was ready to the point that it was infuriating to him, and he pushed me out and kind of made me do Armageddon, uh-huh. which I thought was very interesting. But she also talked a lot about like how intolerant she is of unsupportive people in the industry, particularly towards women.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to hear her take of like what she's thinking about James Cameron today. I'm sure she's ready to blow up his car or something.
Oh yeah, she's ready to give, because they were married at one point,
right?
And I'm sure this is probably like the same old story for her. She's and I don't mean to say that I know anything about
right.
the married life of James
sure.
Cameron, but you know, he has married two very high-profile, very prolific Hollywood producers and director in the case of Kathryn Bigelow, and they all kind of went their separate ways.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Maybe it's...
Maybe there's a reason for that.
Yeah, maybe there's a reason for that.
Well, I mean, one might say, and like I'm not a mental health professional, but it does look like a very tempting pattern to kind of try to dive into, that he has had this romantic attraction to very powerful women, and yet like puts them on screen as long as they fit a certain thing. It's like, if you cross
yeah.
this, you're out. And I think that's really interesting, just kind of to try to speculate about the psychology of James Cameron, of you can be as powerful but not too powerful.
Right. For kind of from what you were saying, he's almost got, it almost seems like he has this covetous view of the strong female lead. Like, he helped mold it and he created that cultural movement. And he wants it. He's just
yeah.
like a creepy kind
of
like.
But what's interesting, and there's been a little bit of discussion about this before, so this is by no means an original thought, pointing to Ripley and to Sarah Connor, looking at that. They were powerful women, but they both had something with them that made it okay to be badass, because it's okay to be badass if you are Mama Bear.
Right.
If
yeah.
you are defending a child. So in the case of Newt on the ship,
that's
like
true.
Suddenly it was
wow.
okay for Ripley to be completely ferocious and fight very hard, because it's not
yeah.
about just saving herself, it's about saving this child. Ditto with Sarah Connor, it's about her son there. So I think there's an interesting thing, like it's okay to be powerful if you have a good and reasonably feminine reason for doing so.
Yeah, it's not just, you know, man goes on rampage,
yeah.
you know, which is pretty common, I'd
yeah.
say.
In the wake of the death of the family or whatever.
Yeah, like,
know.
they're just, men are on screen are pretty much allowed to just go apeshit whenever they want.
Or
so.
Claim any level of power
yeah.
without having like a...
Justification.
Right.
Yeah.
Not
right.
too much, right? They don't need a lot.
They don't need a lot. Like, you can just be a psycho.
Yeah.
You know, you can just be a lunatic and go be a very powerful serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
You can just decide, well, this is wrong and I'm going to go, you know, fix this, or like suddenly your protagonist can have a major life affirming moment by like sitting at a freaking stoplight and watching something happen, not even that big a deal. But like for a woman to do that, it's got to be, it's got to really kick her very hard for her to be able to take that. She almost like, you almost need to often get, see a female character get permission from a male character or from a male power structure in order for her to go take that in a in an acceptable way.
And to and without the, at the risk of sounding too dark, I think that's why the prevalence of this is getting talked a lot about more is rape scenes as a justification for a woman to experience character growth. Like that's the only way they can do it. Or if they find out that they're barren, like they can't have children, that's the only way they can have character growth. And I think it's all tied to the same thing about when are women allowed to be multidimensional characters on screen.
Right.
And there's like a finite level of things that you can do.
And when does our power, not power or pivot anyway, not have to come from childbearing,
like
child
a gender
rearing,
role.
Or our vaginas. When is it not about that? And it seems like that is harder and harder to come by. I think that like the rape point is a very good one because, or the reproductive point. I think those are really two very good points because absolutely, it why does it have to be like about your vag to evolve?
I do want to continue on with, I really like the idea of the, of this kind of Hollywood privilege, this white male Hollywood privilege. And this I would almost is the misappropriation, I guess I want to call it like faux feminist privilege, because this is Mr. Joss Whedon is the king of this. He has always been touted as the man who loves women in Hollywood.
Champions them.
Yeah, champions them. He created Buffy. He created Firefly. He created Dollhouse. He has been always someone who's looked at as being a champion of women in Hollywood. However, his ex-wife, Kai Cole, wrote a very, you know, pretty serious letter alleging that Whedon spent about 2 decades lying to her about multiple affairs and how he uses his feminism, his self-purported feminism, of course, as a shield. And I find that really interesting because I've always kind of had this feeling about Joss Whedon that he does he would hide behind that to justify anything that he did. And it's a very easy justification to make because you're like, oh, no, I swear I'm feminist. Look, I made Buffy. And Buffy was so important to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Not myself. I mean, I watched a little bit of Buffy here and there, but it was a cultural phenomenon at the time for a lot of people.
And it makes critics a little, it's difficult to be clear-eyed about some of his work then.
Right, yeah. If you have such an emotional connection to it and you think, oh yeah, no, Buffy is feminist, so Joss Whedon must be a feminist. Amy, could you tell me, like, do men do this with the idea of the feminism shield? Is this a thing? Like,
yes.
Again, it's two white dudes.
Yeah.
It is definitely a thing. To some extent, it's sort of been labeled lately as woke misogynist, as either someone who purposefully uses feminism as a tool of manipulation, or someone who really just doesn't know better. I mean, I saw a lot of, you know, what's great about social media is that it democratized media so that anyone can have a voice, and that's great. And sometimes a really excellent piece can rise out of obscurity and be, you know, the New York Times knows about it the next day. And that's an exciting time that we're in. The downside of that is that any time in the news cycle, you get so many hot takes.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, 16 white men have all said the same thing today on Medium. Kick ass, right? And so there's a little of that. But like the woke misogyny thing, there were so many of this kind of like, oh my gosh, you feminists, like around the Women's March.
Right.
Here's what you feminists need to do. Like, how about sit the fuck down and just let us deal with this, please? You know what I mean? Like, don't tell women how to fix feminism. You have, like, don't do that. So it's like, I'm totally down with men identifying as feminists, and I think it's important to do so. But it bothers me when it's like, you still have to check your privilege. You still have to say, I'm not a woman. I have never been a woman. I don't know, but I'm guessing this, or better, tell me.
Yeah.
Like, even better. Help me understand that, you know. Just listen. Like, shut your mouth and listen. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I feel like is happening with Joss Whedon. Like, he's not acknowledging the fact that, in fact, he is not female and has, as far as I know, never been female.
Right.
Like, acknowledge that part. Second of all, what's so funny to me about him is, like, because people always point to Buffy. Same deal. It's like he gets away with crap because he's got, like, he gets away with being sort of racist because he's got a black friend. Mm-hmm. Like, just because you made Buffy doesn't mean you can't be a complete douche.
Right.
Further, any woman that has ever spent time in a comic book shop, which I have, there's, like, the joke of the way you measure the safety and welcomingness of a comic book shop is if you walk in by yourself, not with a dude, or you walk in with another woman, if you are immediately directed to the Buffy comics, you know the place is not for you.
Yeah.
Because it's about, you are a girl, you need girl things. Here's some tough girls.
Buffy.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that's, like, always my test of a comic book shop. And it's hilarious how many times that cliche falls into place. That's happened in several in this city. I always point to Third Coast Comics and Edgewater as being my favorite in the favorite comic book shop in the city. Not only have I become good friends with the owner, who is a really awesome person and a fierce crusader of women's issues and social justice issues generally, but he makes fun of that. And he recognizes that's just not a thing that happens in my shop. And he has... such a great, you know, he champions local artists. He doesn't organize, you know, there's so many comic book shops that have, like, here's the corner of women. So I've even seen it labeled, like, here's chicks kicking ass, like those words. And he just has, you know, quality characters and that might have a local source. This might be written in a, I don't know, these might be in Spanish, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, he's got them categorized by more logical things outside of
than just women.
Race and gender. Yeah. So I think, like, Buffy's always kind of a funny thing to point to anyway, because we all kind of roll our eyes at it anyway. Buffy's fine. Buffy's cool. Buffy's great. I cannot, I can never watch How I Met Your Mother without going, it's Buffy. I mean, there she is, right? It's not Lily, it's Buffy, right?
Yeah.
So, but I mean, it's, again, it's another example of this guy just, like, no, you're, like, stay in your lane, guy.
Yeah. And he's got this kind of history of bulldozing sort of feminism. And even in 2013, and this is coming from a great piece at the AV Club called Joss Whedon Was Never a Feminist by Laura Browning.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Laura Browning. This is a great piece that kind of breaks it all down. And she writes that in 2013, Joss Whedon spoke at an Equality Now fundraiser, and he basically spent, like, a quarter hour picking apart the word feminist and why he hates it because it uses ist at the end of it and isms. And it's like this, just like he tries to qualify it by calling out misogynists. He's just like, oh, pathetic, prehistoric, rage filled, inbred ass clowns.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, good for you.
Yeah.
You know how to make an insult. But
he acts like his feminism is just something that is innate to him and that he's never.
Yeah. I don't like to call it an ism.
Yeah.
It is an ism, isn't it?
But again, like, here's another, like, if we put this in a different context, it becomes super clear, and that is this. So I immediately think of the way that people right now in the political dialogue are saying things like, well, I'm not going to say, I'm not going to say LGBTQ, I don't subscribe to that, you know, quote, politically correct crap, right? And I always say, if you hear someone say politically correct garbage or politically correct crap, whatever, switch it out with the phrase treating people with respect, because suddenly it'll be a tell. Like, I don't believe in saying transgender because I don't believe in that politically correct crap. Well, suddenly, because I don't believe in treating people with respect.
Right.
It is not up to a white guy to decide what feminism gets called. It's not like you don't get to call, like, you can't walk up and say, hey, group, you'd do a lot better if you would just
rebrand,
call yourself something else. I mean, to me, that's really in line with, like, policing anger. You know, I saw a lot of this around the time of the Women's March. People were like, see, the Women's March was peaceful. Black Lives Matter activists should learn from them. And I was like, okay, yo, listen to me. It's not about that there were no men there. I think that's a factor, but it was a lot of white women, like, recognize that the cops are just not going to screw with a bunch of affluent white women decked out in pink, quite in the same way they will a bunch of women of color. And so it's a matter of recognizing privilege and stay in your lane, Joss Whedon. You don't get to, like, you don't get to describe, you know, why the word feminism is problematic. And I remember when that happened, and I remember everybody losing their minds over it, and rightly so, because it was just so, like, I mean, put it in any other lens. Like, if he was talking about any other group, it would be so absurd if he walked out and he was like, okay, here's the thing with Latinas.
Yeah.
I'd
yeah.
be like, what a racist psycho, you know?
Yeah.
It would be very quick, but it's like when there's something still, there's such a stronghold still of kind of that masculine power structure that that is so frustrating that we see in so many ways. Sometimes we don't even see it. Sometimes it's so deeply ingrained, it's hard to even see, that for some reason, like, it's not a problem for a guy to say, ah, no, it's cool, I can say this, I'm a feminist. Like, well, no, not really.
Yeah.
Not really. No. Like, why don't you not do that, actually, Joss
yeah.
Whedon?
So exactly.
If Joss Whedon isn't a feminist, which I think that there's a decent amount of evidence, both in action and in words, that he isn't, what is he? He's just another rich, powerful white man that
yeah.
gets to take advantage of women because of his stature.
Yeah, he's, as always, I've always had a problem. Then this is before I really dug more into his actions as a proposed feminist. I've always had a problem with him being the geek icon. Like, I don't like anybody really that gets pushed forward as the end all be all of anything. I think people can have, you know, very influential opinions on things and can be looked to as role models, but no one is the end all be all of geekdom. And he's always loved having that being part of his ego. He's got such a massive ego because he made the Avengers, he made Buffy, he made Firefly. Everybody loves Joss Whedon. And I've always seen the problem with his personality in that respect. And this only seems to affirm that, yes, he is just another egomaniacal white kid that probably got bullied in high school. And instead of learning from it and becoming a better person, he just became the power hungry person he always wanted to be. And, you know, Joss Whedon, feel free to hit me up on Twitter, at Mount Hushmore. I'm dead serious. Bring it on, dude. I don't have...
I can't wait for this Twitter fight.
Yeah. Honestly, I have no qualms with talking to you about, you know, why you're so full of him. Why he's so full of himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who cares? Like...
Well, I think that's what we're seeing with both of these guys, right?
Yeah.
We're seeing, like, very powerful men in the... in, you know, the Hollywood space, who have a lot of power, a lot of money, a huge platform, and unbelievable egos. Like, the fact that, no, I will tell you what a powerful woman is, and she better not be too pretty, and she better only be powerful because she's taking care of a child,
yeah.
and that better be the source of her rage. Like, how fragile is your ego that that's the only way you can define powerful womanhood? Similarly, I think with Joss Whedon, like, I'm good with feminism. In fact, I'm so good with it, I'm going to teach you ladies how to do it better.
Yeah.
And the thing is, all they had to do was just not do anything.
Right.
Yeah.
The right move is to shut up and
yeah.
don't do anything. Right.
Unbelievable.
What you should have said was nothing.
Yeah.
Amy, thank you so much. As so insightful. I think we learned a lot, Connor. And I think that's what we're all about here on NoCo Cinema, is learning a little bit every single week about something we might not know a lot about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Amy.
Gladly.
You can catch
you.
Her every single week, for the most part, on the Saturday Night Special. And that's on WGN Radio on 720 AM. You can find it on WGNRadio.com. She also does the Saturday Business Lunch. She's also she's founder of Strange Ways. She's also... Can you just send me a list every day of what new things you're doing? Because she's so prolific and so out there to do so many great things.
I just feel like there's so much to do. We've got one shot. We just have to do a lot of stuff. Also, I get bored easily, so
yeah.
I have to keep myself entertained.
Idle hands are the devil's playthings.
It's true.
Absolutely.
And I hear for the Saturday Night Special, you have a pretty, you know, a pretty great producer, too.
It's true. I do. I have the greatest damn producer ever.
Bring him on the show. Bring him on the show sometime. All right. So thank you all for joining us here on NoCo Cinema. You can catch us every Monday, usually at about noon, but there's a little bit of wiggle room there. I don't know. We're loose.
Yeah.
We're loose with that. Thank you so much, Amy, and thank you so much, Connor, for coming every week, even though we hate each other. But we also love each other.
Let's put a pin in that.
We'll put a pin in that. Therapy session next Tuesday. This has been NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. See you next week. I'm gonna try to project today. I'm gonna really try to
finally
project. We're gonna turn on some fucking professionalism, Tom. Can you do a job?
Now you're gonna stop phoning it in? Why is now?